Morning 22, Radio Great Southern. Well, you might remember a couple of months ago we spoke to South Australian author Fiona McCallum. It was her second book called Nowhere Else. We did talk to her last year when she had her first novel published called Paycheck. Well, now, believe it or not, number three has been released. It's called Wattle Creek. And the lovely Fiona has joined us on the line from Adelaide today. Hello, Fiona. How are you? Welcome back.
Hi, Pat. Thank you. Lovely to be talking with you again.
You're becoming quite a regular, aren't you?
Yeah, you're going to have to give me a paid gig there.
Oh, yes. Don't hold your breath. Well, since we last spoke to you, of course, Things have happened because Nowhere Else took off like anybody's business, and you're number two in the writing genre. What else has happened? You've been doing personal appearances, you've been writing books and done a few interviews and what have you, and look, it's all happening. You've had a lead story in the Good Reading magazine, front page story there. How are you coping with all this?
It's been a crazy ride, Pat. I'm trying not to think about it too much and trying to stay focused on actually writing and getting the books out there, because that's what I love to do, and putting out good quality books. But yes, it is all a bit distracting at times.
Well, it is, one would imagine, because you now consider yourself, when you are, in fact, a full-time writer. You've got so many things going around in your brain for new ideas and new books. And I suppose some of these things are a bit of a distraction to a certain extent.
They are, and I have probably at any one time about five different stories fighting for attention. So I'm desperate to finish the current book so that I can work on the next storyline, and that's a constant. So there's this constant desperation, I guess, to get something finished, to get started on the next thing. But it's a lot better than wondering what I'm going to write about.
Well, that's very true. I mean, the inspiration's obviously there. But it's interesting that that Nowhere Else took off. And I suppose, one, I would have called it sort of rural romance, but there's a different term for it, isn't there, called farm lit or something?
Yes, I think There's rural romance, rural lit, farm romance too, I think. But and that's what people call it. And basically, it's just any story that has a rural setting. Most of the authors in this genre that I've been put into tend to write primarily romance-based stories, whereas I don't see my stories as being like that. Mine, in my mind, are a journey of self-discovery story first and foremost, with a romantic element underneath. So I see myself as slightly different, but it's all about marketing, and I believe readers need to know and have some idea of where a particular book fits into the whole writing thing, you know, on the bookshelf.
Yeah. Now, of course, the other thing is that we have seen, you know, lots of books sort of publicising and glorifying, you know, rural Australia and saying what a wonderful place it is. But it's not that easy. It's a much tougher place to live than people understand, it seems to me.
I think so. And I think I'm in a really lucky position where I'm able to see it from the other side of the fence now, because I spent the first 26 years of my life on a farm, married to a farmer, you know, being raised in a really small community, and then I did the corporate thing and lived interstate in Melbourne and Sydney. So I guess I'm able to see it a bit more clearly now, and be able to see the good and the bad. And there are lots of good things about rural life and small communities, you know, especially when they band together during bushfires and disasters and things. But as you point out, there is a tough element, and there are difficulties that go with being a close-knit community, people knowing your business, people knowing of you, and having an interest in knowing what you're up to, and that adds a certain amount of pressure when you go through tough times, because people are interested. It's not like when you live in the city, no one knows what you're going through or comments or gossips. And I think it can add a lot of pressure, extra pressure, to someone who's going through a difficult time already.
All right, well, let's talk about Wattle Creek. Having read it, it's a tremendous book. I think you might, but in a very positive way, open a Pandora's box. First of all, and there are three elements to that. And the first one I want to talk about, of course, is farmer suicide, because that's the very basis of which you start this book, a young farmer who thinks his life's wasted, feels there's not much left, and puts a bullet in a gun and thinks about shooting himself. That is a very real picture out there in rural Australia, and it is rising, unfortunately.
Absolutely. And, you know, every now and then the media comes up with a story and it's in the media for a little while, but then it goes away again. And as much as Wattle Creek is a work of fiction, the emotion behind it is very real. I write from the heart and write what I know, and I've been through a pretty dark period in my own life, so that's where that comes from. But yes, Damien is a farmer on the brink, and he is thinking of shooting himself. He has a less than supportive mother, and he's been raised with the notion that you do not discuss your problems with anyone. Therefore, you don't seek help. And so that has pushed him right to the edge because, you know, as I was saying before, it's that extra pressure of people knowing your business, talking about you, then talking about you as part of a whole family, and then the whole family being spoken about. And it adds that extra dimension of pressure. And so that's where Damien is at. And it is a difficult topic.
Yeah, and particularly when you think that, you know, suicides, male youth suicides and younger people in rural Australia is likely to occur at twice the rate of that in the metropolitan area. Mm. That puts the whole thing in perspective, doesn't it?
It does, and I think in the country, you know, we've all got stuff we deal with every day, and everything's relative to our environment, our jobs and everything. We're all dealing with stuff. I think where it's even more difficult for people in rural communities and especially farmers is it's often a lonely occupation. Mm. Farmers are often out there on the land on their own. Sometimes they might have a wife. At the moment, you know, as we've seen with a lot of these shows popping up, like Farmer Wants a Wife,
yeah,
they are having trouble finding women out there because women go off in search of better opportunities, the bright lights, the big city, and they leave. And so, you know, there are less chance of finding a wife. So these farmers are out there, and often the occupations involved with farming are lonely occupations, like, for instance, sitting alone on a tractor going round and round and round, and, you know, working with your sheep, mustering on a four-wheel motorbike or whatever on your own.
Mm.
And it gives you so much time to think, and often that thinking time isn't necessarily a positive thing.
Yeah. Now, of course, the other matter that you raise in this is this whole question of depression, which, of course, is, a common factor, not only in urban Australia, but more particularly in rural Australia, for very much the reasons that you just talked about.
Mm.
And depression, of course, is one of those, there's a stigma about it, isn't there?
There is, and I think, you know, as much as there are great organisations out there that are promoting understanding and advertising and trying to change that, it's a really difficult thing to understand. And often the person that is suffering it doesn't understand it. And so how can you expect someone around you who's never felt like that to understand what you're going through? And depression also, I believe, and I'm no medical practitioner, I've just lived what I've lived and seen what I've seen, but I believe that it manifests itself in so many different ways. So no two people's experience of it is the same. And so that makes it a really tricky thing for the wider community to deal with, I think.
Mm. Now, The other problem, of course, is that males, and, well, particularly young males, are less likely to want to go to doctors. I mean, the majority of people who go and see medical practitioners are, in fact, women in this country. Men tend not to want to go to doctors, even more so if they've got something like depression.
That's right. And, again, you know, if you're in the country, in the one, you know, doctor practice where the people that you rub shoulders with in the pub are the people sitting in the waiting room or behind the desk at the reception desk wondering why you're there, that adds that extra dimension of pressure. And yes, you rightly point out that it's a struggle to get men to the doctor in the first place, let alone when there is that feeling that everyone is watching me and everyone's going to be standing around in the pub wondering why I was there and speculating. You know, it's near on impossible. You can imagine they wouldn't want to put themselves through that.
And the whispers in the town, did you see so-and-so at the doctor, so I wonder what's wrong with him.
That's right. And you know, I've heard people say about depression and, you know, comparisons to other illness, or mental illness particularly, that, you know, at least when you've got a bandage around your hand or your head or a bruise or whatever, people can see what it is that's wrong with you. But there's a real feeling of, oh, I don't understand it, so I don't want to get involved when it comes to mental illness. And yes, farmers, like most men, tend to only go to the doctor if they absolutely have to, like they've lost half their arm or something.
Now, the third element of the Pandora's box that I mentioned is one which I hope this book of yours will become a social document, and that is this question of, A, going to the doctor, who then says, here, take some pills and go away. Now, it seems to me that we hand out pills like lollies, and they do, in fact, to cure anti-depression and what have you. But there's some interesting studies. In fact, we had a major story a couple of weeks ago coming out of the States where they did some controlled studies on patients, two groups. They gave them one group antidepressants, they gave the other the placebos. And it's fascinating that the results from the two groups were almost identical. Those who got the placebo said they felt better.
That doesn't surprise me at all.
No, and it's this mind over matter thing. But even further than that, and which is very encouraging, one hopes that maybe the authorities in this country will get the message, and that is that the British government has now laid down the law to medical practitioners that they will not supply to people with mild or ordinary depression tablets. They can supply them to people with severe depression, and what the government has done is established a mentoring task force of 7,000 people across the UK to help these people, to talk to them and get them involved in exercise programs and a whole range of other things to get them back into a positive frame of mind. In other words, stop giving them pills to solve the problem.
Yeah, and it's not, you know, the dangerous line that you tread with all of this is the helping people versus, you know, doing something actually constructive to help people get their lives back together versus someone who doesn't really understand what that person's going through, saying, now, come on, pull yourself together, it's okay. And anyone who's actually suffered depression, and I don't know to what level I had it when I went through my marriage breakup, but I know for a fact that I literally could not drag myself out of bed. There was just nothing could get me out of bed some mornings because it just wasn't worth doing. And, you know, you do have to learn to be positive again and take those tiny steps. And, you know, a great thing for me was to consider each hour, you know, deal with each hour as it came. And as silly as that sounds, that really helped me get through because you only have to worry about that hour.
But in those dark days, though, you did at one stage think about driving off a cliff. Come on.
I did. Mm. I did. And, you know, who knows whether I would have or not, but there was a, you know, a little light in my head, you know, that, no, I had to find some help. And I did go looking for a particular person who stood there looking at me when I found them, and I was a mess. What is wrong with you? Pull yourself together. And I realised that person, obviously, it was like a bang over the head with a frying pan, that person wasn't the person that was going to help me. And then the next wave of, you know, feeling really, really bad, I managed to get myself to not the doctor, because, again, it was the same for me. I didn't want people knowing that I was sitting in there and why I was there. But I managed to remember that there was a school counsellor at my old high school, and I'd been out of school for, oh no, over 10 years, I suppose, but I remembered where her office was. And she was my saviour, Pat. She absolutely pulled me out of it and told me I needed to get out of that environment, and that was very practical help. You know, there were no pills involved. And I ended up, this was when I left the local community, and I went to Adelaide, to the big city, just to have a break and to get away from that, what, you know, I was finding toxic environment. And it's interesting you say about pills being handed out willy-nilly, because I had an interesting experience. I was staying with an aunt, and I got a flu, really bad cold. I was really quite unwell, and I decided I probably should see a doctor and make sure I didn't have, you know, pneumonia or something serious. So I trotted off to a random doctor at a clinic, and this doctor happened to say, oh, you know, what's going on in your life? And I said, well, look, just having a going through a marriage breakup, things are pretty bad. And he said, how are you sleeping? I said, oh, well, obviously I'm not. You know, I'm really having trouble sleeping. And he handed me a prescription and said, here, take these.
Oh, yes.
And gave me antidepressants without actually, you know, really getting into it or suggesting I see a psychologist or someone. And I think, you know, as much as GPs are really important, they don't specialise. They're general. And I think mental illness needs a specialist.
Mm.
And especially out in the country, you've got, you know, GPs are fantastic, but they deal with so many different things. And, you know, they're not specialists in any particular field like depression. And,
exactly.
You know, it's just tough. But sorry, I'm getting off.
No, you're not, because, you see, you know, I believe, you know, hopefully... You know, this book of yours, Wattle Creek, is going to ring some bells, because it's opened up and it's put on the front page of papers, you know, this whole thing about mental illness and depression and what have you, and how we approach it in this country. And, you know, handing out pills is not the answer.
No, and I don't think it is. And I don't know, honestly, what the answer is, because until, you know, every single person in the world has experienced it themselves...
Mm.
They can't understand, and it's not anyone's fault, you know. And I see this ad that's doing the rounds at the moment where they have captions of what people are thinking, but what's coming out of their mouth is completely different. I don't know if you've seen the ad.
Sounds like politicians.
Yeah, but it's like a sort of skirting around the issue of mental illness, like someone's been away from work and come back and they just don't know how to deal with that person, and then eventually someone sort of says, oh, look, if there's anything we can do, and that person is mightily relieved because, you know, there's a feeling that they understand. Well, yeah. I think it's a bit simplistic.
Yes.
Because no one can possibly understand, and that, I reckon, there's the big problem, is that it's all very well for legislators and even doctors to be discussing it, but if you haven't experienced it, how can you really help?
Mm. And of course, the other side of the coin, of course, is that if you don't have supportive families, of course, then that doesn't help either.
No, and I have a view that if you are in a family that encourages you, tells you that, hey, you're great, no matter what you do, we all make mistakes, but as long as, you know, you do your best and ultimately we want you to be happy, if someone's raised in a family like that, and I know every parent would say, oh yes, I raised my child like that, and they probably think they did, but until those words are actually spoken, it means nothing. But if someone's raised in an environment like that and totally, absolutely knows and feels that they are in that environment, I wouldn't mind betting that the stats would show that that person is less susceptible to mental illness and depression. And again, I'm not a medical practitioner or by any stretch, but I can't help wondering about the nature versus nurture thing. And, you know, then on the other side of the coin is the person that's raised in a family that feels that they, no matter what they do, will never measure up. You know, cold parents who are not verbally affectionate or physically affectionate. And, you know, ultimately, if you keep doing things that don't get any, what's the word?
Well, I suppose acceptance is a word.
Yeah, acceptance and approval and all of those things, your life starts to feel pretty meaningless over time. And I can imagine that those people will be the people that ultimately end up in that absolute sense of despair that then may eventually lead to suicide if they don't remove themselves from that toxic environment. And as a society, we're taught and programmed that family is everything. And if that family is the toxic part of your life, it makes it pretty difficult.
It does. And that really means, to a certain extent, you've got to shed that family and get out and get away from it all.
Yeah, at least temporarily until, you know, you feel some worth again.
Yeah, yeah.
Because, you know, it's like if you are living beside a toxic dump in your house and you are feeling ill, and you realised that was what was making you ill, say you had people come in and test the air or whatever, and you discovered that that was what was making you ill, well, you would do your utmost to move house. And so I believe that, you know, emotionally and mentally, that can happen to you without you realising, and you need to take a step back and assess the contributors to why you're feeling like that and remove yourself.
Mm. Now, of course, whilst there is this dark side in Wattle Creek, of course, like all your stories, it does end up with a happy ending at the end. But it's the trials and tribulations that this young farmer, in fact, goes through. And the fascinating thing is that he gets himself a little Jack Russell, which in many respects, along with a young lady who's a psychologist who helps him along the way. But it's that feeling actually of ownership of somebody who will give you unconditional love.
Absolutely. And, you know, again, this is an experience of mine where animals and pets, I'm a huge animal lover, Pat. I've grown up with animals and I will not live without a pet. And they are important. And when you're going through something like, you know, I cannot get out of bed in the day, life just seems just not worth it. When you're feeling like that, just having that little face of that dog or that cat or rabbit or whatever you have looking at you, loving you, can make all the difference, I believe. And then sometimes it will be that animal and having to get up and walk it or get up and feed it that can pull you through.
That's the stimulation, isn't it?
That's right. And that need to take care of someone else and not be so self-absorbed.
Yeah.
You know, someone's relying on me, so, you know, I can't go through with this because what happens to that animal? You know, and that can drag people out and back into a better state of mind.
Indeed,
I believe.
I think you're dead right there. But I thought the fire scene in Wattle Creek is quite fascinating. Did you go through a bushfire while you were on the farm?
Came close, didn't actually go through that, but I think that scene I wrote after watching some of the footage from the, you know, big fires that went through King Lake,
yes,
etc., in Victoria. But I think when I was about 12, I remember being woken up early on a Sunday morning in the middle of summer, mum and dad saying, look, you better get up and get dressed, we've got a fire out the back. And, you know, there was just action stations of filling up tankers and, you know, getting shovels and preparing, arming ourselves and, you know, getting out there and dealing with it. But no, I haven't lost a house.
No, which he did, of course. And, of course, that, in many respects, in this book, of course, is the turning point for him, to a certain extent, to get a new beginning, if you like.
Absolutely. And that is a great tribute to Jacqueline, his psychologist, who has helped him through, because he's finally got to a point, after being so miserable and so down on himself and, you know, the world's bad and life is horrible, that you would think that someone like that would lose everything in a fire and just completely crumble. But it's an absolute tribute to what Jacqueline's done for him, that he's able to essentially shrug his shoulders and say, well, hey, no lives were lost. Mm. It's okay, I can rebuild from this. And he does rebuild, and, you know, I won't give the story
away. No,
we
won't tell the story, no.
You know, he has an inspiration that takes him beyond merely just picking himself up. He goes in a different direction. And, yeah, and when I think about it, if I think too long about it, I could cry.
Yeah.
Because it's a beautiful thing.
Yeah, and there's a bit, one has to say, you know, take Damien and substitute Fiona, and there's a bit of you in this, isn't there?
Absolutely. You know, as I said, I've been through tough times in my life. I've got a great love of the land. My journey is in there as well of, you know, stick Fiona on the farm as Damien, and that's my journey of, you know, leaving a partner in Sydney and changing direction completely, taking a huge risk to try and make it as a novelist, you know, against the odds, and it's been tough, but, you know, tough things are worth getting through in order to prosper.
Well, you're not doing a bad job.
Honestly, I pinch myself sometimes because, you know, here I went 9 years struggling to get published, and I'd get rejections and I'd sit on the couch for 2 days and cry, and then eventually I, you know, would sort of wait 6 months and then go, oh, all right, I'll send something out again. And now I've got 3 books out in about 12 months and it's just crazy.
Yeah, and what's more, you've got a whole stack more on the drawing boards.
I do, and I'm just so blessed, Pat, that I found a publisher who understands me and didn't want to change me. And, you know, not unpublished writers trying to get published roll their eyes if I say this, but I absolutely, hand on heart, believe this, that I had to wait 9 years to find the right publisher. And Harlequin are fantastic, and there's a beautiful team of people turning my, you know, plain pages into beautiful-looking books. And then, of course, there's, you know, I wouldn't be where I am if it wasn't for beautiful readers. And I get so many emails from readers saying how much my books have touched them. And, you know, as an author, you just can't get better than that.
I reckon there might be an avalanche after this one, though. I've just got this feeling that, as I said at the beginning, you've opened a Pandora's box, and maybe, just maybe, things might somewhat start to change in this country in the way we deal with depression.
Yeah, I think we've got to keep looking at different ways, because I don't think it's working at the moment, and I think that raising awareness is the key, but that's not enough. I don't have an answer, unfortunately. But I did have a reader put a note on Facebook. She's just read it and said, wow, I don't think I've ever seen one of the rural authors deal with this subject. So,
it's been taboo. It's been taboo up to date. And I think you might have just opened the door. And I certainly hope so. And I hope that, you know, people in certain high places actually, you know, get this referred to them so that they can actually think, hey, hang on, Matt, are we doing this the right way?
Yeah, well, I never wanted it to be... I deliberately didn't do a lot of research for the book. That was deliberate. I wanted it to just be a story with this as a central subject so that it would be a down-to-earth, light read that would get people thinking. And, you know, it might be a naive sort of cliched view, but if one person read this and chose not to go down that path as a result, I would just be ecstatic. You know, not that I would ever know.
No.
But you know, I've deliberately put phone numbers in the back for people because, you know, no one has to know that this nice book they're carrying around has that as a reference in the back, that, you know, they, if they're feeling bad, they might do something about phoning.
Yeah, there is help. There is help out there.
There absolutely is, and I honestly do believe a problem shared is a problem halved. And I think people need to talk to other people and not be afraid to seek help despite how they were raised, because your parents and, you know, we all grow up living by a set of values and rules and whatnot passed down to us or passed on to us, and there's no way of knowing what's right or wrong. And things change and ideas change, and I think we need to continue to change with them and just not accept that the way we were raised is necessarily the way.
Last time we spoke, you said you were planning on a book a year. You've done 3 in 18 months.
Well, they were already written, so that's how I look like I've been, you know...
Yes, productive.
...insanely busy. And I have been busy.
Oh, yes.
But I haven't been that good at getting the books out. But I still... That's my aim, is a book a year. And, you know... all good plans and all that. We'll just see what the universe has planned for me. You know, there's no point forcing these things.
No, but a trilogy is next on the list, is it not?
I'm not sure. There is a manuscript.
Oh, there's another one, is there?
there is a manuscript that is with Harlequin at the moment that I haven't heard if they want to publish or not. But if they don't, then I'm working on a trilogy. And the first two books of that should be ready to go, and then I'm writing the first draft of the third book, and now I'm being plagued with a potential fourth book that is actually a prequel to all of it. So it's all quite exciting, and as I said earlier, I'm just lucky that I have so many ideas running around my head, although it does get a bit clogged at times.
It keeps you out of mischief.
It does indeed.
Well, Wattle Creek is a very thought-provoking book. It's a fascinating book. It's one that people will enjoy. There's no doubt about that. But it's going to prick a few consciences, one would hope. And it's published by Harlequin, of course. It is available in all good bookstores. And Fiona, it is a tremendous read. And look, I think it's going to take off. I really do.
Thanks so much, Pat. And I really appreciate your support in talking to me all the time.
Oh, you're welcome. You're welcome. Well, one gets on a good thing, one tends to want to stick to it.
Oh, well, thank you. I just hope that it, you know, continues to enchant readers and inspire and hopefully, yeah, in my tiny little way, change things a wee bit.
Excellent. Fiona McCallum, thank you very much indeed for joining us.
Thank you, Pat.
Fiona McCallum joining us there on the line from Adelaide here on 1422 Radio Great Southern.